Okay, let's get started. We have explored up until last class the confluence, if you will, between the Jewish sources that we have from the sort of late Second Temple period and then early first centuries of the Common Era, on the one hand, and Christian sources from its inception. We can locate that perhaps at the crucifixion or what have you. And subsequent centuries. We talked about confluences between these two, merging of identities, or in fact, the ambiguity in terms of identifying who is a Jew and who is a Christian in the early sources, and even when we have been able to see distinct differences, namely belief in and following of Jesus, at the same time, we've noted that the persistence of fealty to halacha and self-identification as a Jew, even among people that we would now, in retrospect, call Christians, was something that we essentially can take for granted. What we saw last class is that as things began to, and we've seen hints of this in previous classes, but as things began to develop, the identity of some Christians came to be completely disentangled from that of Jews, and in fact, Christians began, some Christians at least, and as we'll see, this class is by no means the rule, even in the 4th century, which we looked at last class, certain Christians began to see their identity as Christians over and against that of the identity of Jews. And in particular, we located, at least in the Roman Empire, we located this occurrence, or this sort of grand disentangling, what we might call a parting of the ways between Jews and Christian, in and around the monumental event of the Council of Nicaea in the year 325 of the Common Era, convened by the Emperor Constantine, at which various issues relating to the self-definition of Christianity were discussed and debated. The most famous one, which we didn't really touch on, was the definition of sort of the nature of Jesus, this won't detain us now, but which deals with a certain group that came to be defined in retrospect as heretical, called the Arians. What we looked at in particular were the debates and the major conflict, in fact, among early Christian thinkers over how to date the events of the crucifixion. And in particular, this related to how Christians dated the holiday of Pesach, which is, of course, coming up. So this was relevant not just for our investigation of history, but also it's in Yom HaYom. What I'd like to look at today is an issue that I think proceeds logically from this. And there, as you'll notice, there are a lot of sources here. I'd like to move through them not a rapid pace, but at a pace where we can sort of be brisk and thorough. What I think proceeds logically from the question of the last, from the conclusions we reached in the last class, and I'd like to throw this out as a question, is this. At this point, once Christians begin to some Christians at least, begin to self-identify as Christians to the exclusion of Jews, what issues might, or what problems might confront you as a Christian? Let's say vis-a-vis paganism, or perhaps even vis-a-vis Judaism. In other words, what if you are not a Christian? You are a Jew, on the one hand, or more importantly, you're a pagan, who's used to dealing with Jews as sort of a social, civic category, but has never seen a Christian before, or at least has only begun to see them in the last couple of years. So what questions might you ask of a Christian? Or how might you attack, let's say, a Christian? What might you say?
At the Council of Nicaea, didn't they sort of determine what they were giving up vis-a-vis, like, we're seeing this and that?
Right.
So that's when they
determined
that they weren't going to...
So that's a good point. That's a good point. The question is, in other words, what was decided as being uniformly accepted at the Council of Nicaea? Question number one. And question number two that question raises is, to what extent were these things accepted by Christians who were not loyal, let's say, or perhaps disinterested in conforming to the policies of Constantine? So those two questions are extremely complex. We're not going to have time to answer them fully now, but why that is important is because it's going to have to call into question one of our assumptions. In other words, an assumption that we might make at this point, after the Council of Nicaea, is that what we saw when we looked at Acts and the Council of Jerusalem and the dissociation of Pauline Christians from the Torah's Moshe, What we saw there is that essentially one big difference between certain Christians and Jews is whether or not you keep halacha. So the question is, to what extent does this hold true even into the 4th century, even as late as the 4th century? Now here, so just to throw out...
You mean that the debate is still going on even?
Yes. In other words, are Christians still debating whether or not you need to keep halacha? In other words, even into the 4th century, 300 years after Jesus was crucified. So here's my question. If you wanted to attack a Christian, and not only in antiquity, I think you hear this, this is sort of a common thing that you hear among Jews or others even today. If you wanted to attack a Christian, so what might be your first avenue of attack? If you're a Jew especially, but even if you're a pagan, what might you say? You're faced with what is this? So one question you might ask is, what is this Trinity? Where does this come from? It's another way of saying, I think, where does Christianity come from? 300 years ago, I'd never heard of Christianity. So now all of a sudden you're telling me that this is a legitimate religious tradition. Why should I believe you? In other words, similar to what a Jew might say. What a Jew might say is, you're asking me to accept the truth of the gospel, whatever it is. Why should I do that? I have my own scriptures. I have the Tanakh. I have the Chumash. I have the Nevi'im. I have the Ksuvim. Why do I need this? So that's a question you might ask. From a pagan perspective, and in a Greco-Roman context, the biggest criterion by which you would judge legitimacy for a tradition in the Greco-Roman world, in the Hellenistic world, would be antiquity. How old are you? So if you're an old faith, an old religion, an old creed, an old philosophy, the older, the better. It's like wine. The older you are, the better. Not how big you are. So no, in fact, if you were small, but very, very ancient, and you'd managed to perpetuate yourself over the centuries, even while being small in number, so that was a sign of great distinction and sophistication. So if you're a Christian, you now have to face the charge from pagans that there is some sort of problem with your religion because it's of recent vintage. Now, if you're a Christian and you are trying to counter these claims, there's going to be one major issue that you're going to have to deal with. Because your obvious response is, well, I am part of this prophetic tradition. So a pagan, and of course a Jew, is going to turn around to you and say, no, you're not. I'm part of a tradition. I, as a Roman, am part of a long tradition going all the way back to Plato, the emperors, Cicero, whoever it may be, Homer. Jews will say, we have a prophetic tradition. We have traditions that have been handed down from father to son for generations. You got to tell Avincha, that holiday is coming up right now. So if you're a Christian, you are going inevitably to have to deal with the question of Masorah, the question of tradition, and how Christianity fits into the notion of ancient tradition. So now, just before we return to that issue in a moment and discuss how, in particular, two extremely different Christian thinkers, one of whom is well-known and one of whom is not, but should be, before we look at how the two of them grapple with this question in very different ways, in polar opposite ways, in fact, what I'd like to do is take a moment to prescind from the Christian issue and focus on the Jewish perspective. In other words, to what extent are Jews concerned with the issue of Masorah, and how early? Take a look at source number one. Source number one is one of the earliest sources that we have on this topic. It's from the Mishnah. The Mishnah, of course, as we've noted several times, is edited by Rav Yehuda HaNasi in the 3rd century of the Common Era. This portion of the Mishnah from Maseches Avos has been edited at that late stage. In other words, there are things that have been added into the Mishnah at that late stage. Hopefully, either the next class or the class after that, we're going to focus on how Rav Yehuda HaNasi shaped the Mishnah. But for now, it's important to note that the pieces that we're going to read now are likely either quite ancient or reflective of ancient tradition. At least that's my belief. So take a look at the Mishnah novels. The Mishnah says as follows, and I've taken out the parts of the really interesting parts of Maseches Avos, and I've just focused on the structure here. So now tell me, as we read this, what sort of message is being conveyed to us by the structure of Avos? I've condensed here about 10 Mishnayos for you, and they read basically as follows. Moshe kibal Torah miSinai umsara liYehoshua. V'Yoshua l'zekeinim, v'zekeinim l'neviim, neviim m'saru al'anshe k'neses ha'gedola, Shimon HaTzadik haya mishyarei Knesset HaGdola. Antigonus ish socho kibel mishimon HaTzadik. Yosef ben Yoezer ish tzereda v'Yosef ben Yochanan ish Yerushalayim kibelu mimenu. Yehoshua ben Parachim v'Nitai Harabeli kibelu mehem. Yehuda ben Tabai v'Shimon ben Shedach kibelu mehem. Shmai v'Avtalin kibelu mehem. Hilo v'Shamai kibelu mehem. So just to briefly recap, Moshe gets the Torah from Mount Sinai. He gives it to his disciple, Yehoshua. Yehoshua then conveys it to the elders of Israel. The elders convey it to their disciples, and so on and so on and so forth, until we get to the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Anshei Knesset HaGadola, as we've mentioned before, is this sort of large amorphous body that seems to have existed during the Persian period. We don't know much more about it than that. All the sources that we have in it are quite late. And then the Mishnah tells us that Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the righteous, one of the early priests just before the Hasmonean period, just before the revolt of the Hashmonaim, was a member, one of the last surviving members, of the men of the Great Assembly. And he passes down the teachings that he received from the prophets to his disciples, all the way down until Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai, of course, we know, is the famous early Canaanitic sages of the Mishnaic period. Now, this is the structure of the Mishnah and Avos. It's sort of interrupted by the sayings that are attributed to each of these figures. But what is this structure trying to tell us? In other words, by arranging the Mishnah in this manner, what is either Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi or whoever arranged it trying to tell us?
Continuous, the Masoret is continuous. It wasn't broken. It has gone from 2,000 years ago to today. Because Shammai and Hillel were what, the 2nd, 3rd century?
Yes, so Shammai and Hillel are the end of the 1st century before the Common Era.
So they're saying, well, look, we have a 2,000-year-old tradition that's never been broken.
Exactly.
And
exactly. So what Chazal are trying to do here is communicate the message that our project, now, and bear in mind, the great sources of Jewish law are primarily not to be found anywhere in Tanakh. The great sources, the primary text of Jewish law, is basically the Babylonian Talmud, the Talmud Bavli. Talmud Bavli is a commentary, such as it were, on the Mishnah. So if we wanted to identify the earliest source of authoritative Jewish law for us, that would be the Mishnah. Now what's the problem that Dr. Schwartzbaum is alluding to? The problem is, who is the earliest figure that appears in the Mishnah? Hillel, Shammai, if we want to go back earlier, Yosef ben Yoezer, who's on this list, Shimon HaTzadik might be on this list. The earliest figures that appear here are all, with perhaps the exception of the end of Daniel, which we saw last semester, but that shouldn't detain us now. Every single figure on this who appears in the Mishnah as teaching halacha is post-biblical. Post-biblical. If you're living in a world that doesn't have a Talmud, that doesn't have a fully developed Torah Shebaal Peh, that would seem ludicrous. How could you have a Jewish legal system without any reference to its primary text, the Tanakh? How? So what Avos does is describe in chronological session by use of a succession list, if you will, that our tradition dates back very, 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 very far. Now, without going into all of the details of how that works and what that means and how this plays out, can we confirm this, can we deny this? Without going into how it plays out, the point is that Chazal are communicating that message. Masorah is extremely important. Now, a person might say, isn't this obvious? Pshita maika mashmon, in other words, why would you have thought otherwise? The answer is that as we're going to see, Masorah and what that means, the implications of Jewish continuity, are in fact a major battleground for Christian thinkers, and I think it has much contemporary relevance for our modern Orthodox Jewish community here on the Upper West Side, and I'll spell that out, I hope, please God, at the end. Now take a look at source number two. Source number two is from one of the first thinkers that we're going to examine who feels that he has to confront the issue of Jewish continuity, and that is Eusebius. We've seen Eusebius before. Eusebius is one of the earliest and most prolific of the church historians. He may, in fact, I'm trying to recall, I think he was the first, the earliest of the church historians. He's a 4th century church historian, and he compiles this massive multi-volume history from the beginning of the church until the end, and he goes through all the sources, and he quotes from primary sources, and in many senses reshapes them. Now, at the very beginning of his work, the very first sentences I've given you here, what I'd like to do is read What I'd like to do is read two portions from the very beginning of Eusebius, wherein Eusebius lays out the goals of his history. And what I'd like you to think about as we're reading is, why are these his goals? And what questions is he going to have to answer in order to accomplish his goals? So let's read. Eusebius says, the chief matters to be dealt with in this work are the following. Number one, the lines of succession from the holy apostles and the periods that have elapsed from Jesus' time to our own. Number two, the names and dates of those who, through a passion for innovation, have wandered as far as possible from the truth, proclaiming themselves the founts of knowledge, falsely so-called, while mercilessly, like savage wolves, making havoc of the flock. These are sort of what he would consider Christian heretics. Number three, the calamities that immediately after their conspiracy against our Savior, Jesus, overwhelmed the entire Jewish race. And then the fourth one is telling about martyrdom, which isn't as important to us now. Those are the four goals. Right? Those are the four goals of Eusebius' study. Number one, to give a history of succession from the beginning of Christianity, whatever that means, we'll see in a moment, until the present day. Number two, to counter the heretics, or what he believes are Christian heretics. And number three is the important one, to discuss all of the bad things that have happened to Jews because they persecuted Jesus. Now, in order to make that... Now, the third claim, I think, is the one that's very important. And in fact, I'd like to put numbers one and two together. Numbers one and three together, leaving out number two for the moment. Eusebius is trying to accomplish what by telling you about, or maybe leave number two in. Eusebius is trying to accomplish what by telling you about the beginning of Christianity until the present day? He's trying to give you a Masora, exactly. He's trying to establish a chain of tradition. Why is he doing this? How does that help perhaps with goal number two? Right, goal number two is to counter what he believes to be heretical Christians. How will establishing a Masora help that? Yeah, if I have a Masora, in other words, if I can tell you, in other words, if my bishop can tell you what his bishop said all the way back to the beginning, then I needn't fear that somebody will come in and pollute my teachings, because I can be completely confident that mine are correct. Now, why, if those are his goals, should he care to document the calamities that befall the Jewish race on account of whatever? Why should that concern him?
If you deviate from the truth, trouble falls.
Right. So the first, in other words, the most obvious explanation that a person might adopt is that, well, if we want to prove that Christianity is true, it might help us if we could document that our mortal enemies, the Jews, from Eusebius' perspective, are suffering. So that, I think, is part of what Eusebius is doing, but I think there's another component here in which, in other words, if that were the whole story, then we would expect him to tell about all of the calamities that befell the people in Category 2 as well, all of the heretics, right? Because their suffering would also confirm his notion of orthodoxy or truth, right? So why is he concerned?
He wants to tag this onto the Jewish same chain.
Excellent. Right. So Sally has noticed the thematic unity between the first and second reason and the third one, which is there is an inherent problem in establishing a Christian Masora, and that is that there is a competing group, the Jews, and at this point for Eusebius, those are two different groups. The Jews have their own tradition. And if the Jews have their own tradition, then shouldn't that disprove our tradition? So he's, by documenting the calamities that befell the Jewish people, well, as we'll see in a moment, those calamities often involve breaks or discontinuities in the Jewish tradition. And I'll give you an example. We're going to skip that next source that I've given you in source number two. The point that I'd like to make there, which is something to bear in mind, and I think because it'll help us frame the debate later on, is that Eusebius frames his history, his multi-volume history, as a response to pagans. So he's not polemicizing against Jews directly. He's going to polemicize against Jews because he's worried about what the pagans will say, namely what we said before. Christianity is a religion of very recent vintage, and therefore it must be made up, it must be nonsense, whatever the case may be. So now take a look at source number three. In source number three, Eusebius makes an interpretative move that serves his goals subtly, but I think very effectively. And what I'd like to do is read this text from Eusebius, and then let's try to suss out exactly what it is that he's doing. So he says, Eusebius writes, and again, this is near the beginning of his study. He says, with regard to all these men who have been witnessed as righteous, going back from Abraham himself to the first man, who is that?
Adam.
Right, Adam. One would not be departing far from the truth in calling them Christians, in practice if not in name. Why? They cared nothing for bodily circumcision, nor do we, nor for keeping of Sabbaths, nor do we, nor for abstentions from certain foods, i.e. they didn't observe kashrus, nor do these things matter to Christians now. So, aside from the empirical claim that Eusebius is making, which I think can be easily dismissed out of hand, what rhetorical move is Eusebius making? What is he trying to claim? In other words, first of all, what are the facts that he's trying to establish? Number one, what is he claiming about Abraham and everybody who basically predated Revelation? They weren't really Jewish. Why? Because what did they not do?
Circumcision.
Exactly. In other words, they didn't keep fealty, they didn't keep loyalty to halacha.
But that gives antiquity and origin to the Hamotiyah. This is the connection.
Exactly. So Mr. Comet is picking up on exactly what Eusebius is doing. Why is he saying this? The reason he's saying this, the reason Eusebius is making this move, is because if you can determine, however acrobatically you may do so, that Abraham and all of the Avos and so on and so forth and all of the pre-Revelation people didn't keep any of the commands that God did in fact give to them, then what have you established? You've established that they were essentially Christians in practice, as he says, if not in name. If that's true, then who truly has a claim to antiquity? Jews or Christians? Obviously Christians. Right? And Jews, now, Eusebius has to obviously explain one major point. Aside from having to explain why Avram didn't have a bris milah, which is a complicated and interesting topic in and of itself, and requires a great deal of mental contortion. But aside from this, Eusebius has to deal with a problem, which we've alluded to already, which is that the Jews have their own Masorah. The Jews have their own Masorah. So why should I take your word for it that Abraham didn't circumcise himself if the Jews have a tradition going all the way back that says that he did?
Because then you could say that ancient man was Christian. The Jews picked up on ancient man and now they're rectifying what they did.
Right.
So it's really a continuity.
So that
our Masorah is a continuity.
Exactly. So that's exactly what Eusebius is going to argue. Eusebius is going to argue exactly that. The Jews messed up. But the question is, he has to deal with the mechanics of this. In other words, how would the Jews have messed up? In other words, if it was so obvious that there was no need, Abraham knew this. You know, Avraham Avinu knew there was no need, chas v'shalom, to circumcise yourself, to keep the law, the dietary laws, and so on and so forth. So if that was the case, how did the Jews forget about this? What went wrong? Take a look at the next, or source number four, I believe, Jewish discontinuity in Eusebius. Eusebius makes the following claim a short bit later. He says, Jesus began his mission in the high priesthood of Annas, that's Hananiah, and continued until the reign of Caiaphas, the period, and the period covered during which he lived, does not stretch to four complete years. For at that time, the ordinances of the law were already obsolescent, and the rule was no longer operative, under which the duties of God's service were hereditary and lasted for life. The Roman governors bestowed the high priesthood first on one, then on another, and the office was held for not more than a single year. So what claim is Eusebius making here about... Well, just to lay out the facts, in other words, Eusebius here has done something seemingly quite innocent and harmless, which is, he simply says, Jesus lived during the priesthood of several different people. Those people seem to have been to have reigned as Kohanim, one right after the other. How could it be that they reigned so quickly? Isn't a person a Kohen Gadol for life? So he explains how it happened. Now, how does that serve Eusebius' purpose here? What has he argued? What has he said about the Kahuna during the time in the wake, or rather just before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? What has he said here? How has he explained why there were so many priests in 4 years? They were appointed by whom?
By the Romans.
By the Romans. Is that allowed? In other words, are the Romans just allowed to assign the kahuna to whomever they please? They could assign it to somebody from Shevet Yehuda for all we know. The claim that he's making is an historical one, And there is some basis to it, although it doesn't mean what he thinks it means. What he's arguing is, and he's quoting Josephus for some of this, what he's saying is that at a certain point, the Kohanim, who Eusebius sees as representative of Jewish tradition and responsible for Jewish teaching, no longer rule in a hereditary fashion as they were supposed to. They no longer descend father from son and are appointed via internal mechanisms as the Torah provides and as the Halakha provides. Instead, they were arbitrarily appointed by Romans. By Romans. Or, as he goes on to indicate later, by Herod. If this is the case, Eusebius is hinting at a discontinuity in the Jewish Masorah. Right? They were supposed to have Kohanim, Yoram Mishpatach Yaakov, they were supposed to have the descendants of Levi teaching Torah to the people, teaching the old traditions to the people, and here we have this break. It must be that things have been forgotten because of that break.
And the imposition of Herod showed discontinuity with the Davidic notion of
Picture. Ah, okay, Mr. Comet's on the ball. So take a look at the next source. No, this is perfect. The next source, and I think what Mr. Comet has intuited is that Eusebius can actually attack this problem from multiple angles. In other words, if we're going to posit discontinuity in the Jewish tradition and argue that they forgot everything that they were supposed to remember, and we have somehow restored it, he has to figure out as many ways as possible to attack Jewish Masorah. So at point number one of attack, or point of entry number one, is the kahuna, the priesthood. Point number two is going to be another Jewish institution. Take a look at source number five, I believe this is. The famous Pasuk in Bereishis, which also famously is incredibly difficult to interpret, and to this day, the Rishonim had an incredibly difficult time interpreting this, the Achronim have a difficult time, modern scholars have a difficult time. Most of the Rishonim have a difficult time because they had to deal with this verse in the context of its Christological use by Christians. But even prior to long prior to the advent of Christianity, the Dead Sea Scrolls struggled with this verse, and so on. And the Septuagint, as we'll see in a moment, struggled with this verse. It's very difficult. So take a look. It's a famous pasuk. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda mechokek mi bein raglav ad ki yavo shilo v'lo yikas amin. The verse, as we have it, from Yaakov's, from Jacob's blessings to his sons, in particular, in this case, to Yehuda, to Judah, says as follows. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Ad ki yavo shilo, as we'll see in a moment, is very difficult to translate. What I've given you here is what I think is the most likely. Until tribute shall come to him, and the homage of the people shall be his. What the pasuk seems to mean, the way that I've translated it, is essentially its structure is as follows. It is comprised of two sections, each one containing two parallels. Right? Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda mechokek mi bein raglav. Right? Two parallel parts. The scepter shall not depart from Yehuda, nor the rule from between his legs, and then Ad kievo shilo v'lo yikas amim. Until the tribute shall be his, and homage shall be paid to him. Those are also two parallel ideas. The basic notion would simply be, Yehuda will be the ruler until he really becomes the full king, and then his kingship will last forever. In other words, Yaakov is simply saying, and this is how I think what the pshat of the Rishonim that don't see this as a reference to the Mashiach boils down to, which is basically that Yaakov is blessing Yehuda here in a very straightforward fashion, as being the tribe from whom kings and rulers will be drawn. I think that's a very straightforward interpretation of the pasuk. Now, the problem is there are so many words in this verse that are incredibly ambiguous, and one of them was so ambiguous that there came to be different versions of what it said. Take a look at the Septuagint, which I've given you just below this. The Septuagint, the Greek, or one of the versions of the Greek translation of the Bible, which was undertaken, according to legend, in I believe the 3rd century before the Common Era, likely took place somewhat after this, but in the last couple of centuries before the Common Era is when these versions of the Septuagint came to be. And this is the version in the Greek translation of the Bible. It is, there shall not be wanting a ruler from Judah, nor a leader sprung from his loins, until he come for whom it is reserved, and he is the expectation of nations. So they're reading Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh V'lo Yikas Amim in a very strange fashion. Ad Ki Yavo, they're not reading Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, they're reading Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh. Right? Until what belongs to him comes to him. V'lo Yikas Amim, they're reading that somehow as all the nations are expecting him. So this, for Christians, obviously gives you ample opportunity to shtup Jesus into there. And this is, in fact, what occurs. Now take a look. Now this pasuk seems to be, at least for a Christian, would seem to say, in the Jewish kings will rule until such a time as they won't rule. And why won't they rule? Because somebody's going to come along and change all this. This is not the pshat in the pasuk, by a long shot, but Eusebius deploys the pasuk as follows, and this is really all that's important to us. What he says is, it was without question in Herod's time that the advent of Christ occurred and the expected salvation and calling of the Gentiles followed at once in accordance with the prophecy cited just above. As soon as the rulers and leaders from Judah, those of Jewish stock, came to an end, not surprisingly, the high priesthood, which had passed in regular succession, generation by generation, was plunged into immediate confusion. Eusebius is saying is this. Eusebius points to Herod. Herod is the king whose reign comes to an end in the year 4 before the Common Era. Herod is the king who is the first king to rule after the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, the dynasty of the Maccabees or the Hashmonaim, and he is seen by later Jewish tradition to not be Jewish. Now, to what extent people actually believed this when Herod was alive seems to me quite unlikely to have been the case. In particular, because all of the sources that we have, and there are many, that dislike Herod, of those sources, none of them attack him for not being Jewish, which would have been a very obvious way to attack Herod. But leaving that question aside for now, it's not our primary objective. What Eusebius is taking for granted that Herod was not a Jew. And he goes to great lengths to try and document that this was the case. So what is he saying? He's saying the kingship of Yehuda will remain constant until such a time as a Gentile is appointed king. Once a Gentile is appointed king, what happens? Jesus comes along. So Eusebius is using this discontinuity, again, in Jewish leadership, the fact that there is now no longer a king, a Jewish king, to explain, first of all, why Jesus comes along now, explains what he would refer to as the incarnation, and it also serves to buttress his claims for Christian antiquity and Christian Masorah, and to disparage Jewish Masorah. Why? Because what has Eusebius documented?
The break of the chain.
Yes, he's documented at least two, and there are more in Eusebius, we can go over them perhaps a different time, two breaks in the chain. The Kohanim have stopped, in other words, the Masorah that we have from the Kohanim has been degraded, and the Masorah that we have via our rulers has become nil, essentially. He doesn't seemingly explain the fact that leadership and kingship had been taken away from Yehuda long before this by the Hashmonaim. That's neither here nor there. He at least sees, well, at least now that there's a Gentile king from his perspective, now the whole thing is going to heck. So this is Eusebius. So ad kan Eusebius. What we see from Eusebius is that one way, and I think this is the most obvious way that we would suspect Christians would deal with Jewish Masorah, one way to deal with Jewish Masorah and the problem that it presents for Christians is to say, well, Jews claim that they have Masorah, but A, we have our own Masorah, and B, our Masorah is superior to theirs, both because ours is older, right? Avraham Avinu was really a Christian. And two, because their Masorah has deficiencies, has ruptures. Their Kohanim haven't stayed constant. Their kings haven't stayed Jewish. So their Masorah is deficient. That's one way of dealing with the problem that something like Maseches Avos would present. In other words, if you have Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misina, Masorah Yeshua, that's a big problem. Yes?
Would that be perhaps a reason that in the Mishnah of Avos, the Kohanim were left out?
So this is a big question. To what extent was there, in other words, to what extent were Kohanim involved in the in the right philosophical circle of the Pharisees, of the Purushim, and in the rabbinic circles, and to what extent were perhaps Chazal antagonistic towards those interests? This is a big question that people have dealt with, and it's a really interesting one. I would note that there are famous Pharisees who are Kohanim. For example, Hananiah Skana Kohanim, according to some versions, that was his name, Hanina. There are major, you know, figures who identify, first of all, as Kohanim, who also identify as Prushim. Another famous one, at least potentially, is, he doesn't appear in Chazal, but we've read a lot of his work. Well, Rabbi Yishmael is another good example. Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol is another example. The famous one, Josephus. And Josephus is, first of all, couldn't be prouder of being a priest, of being a Kohen. He also seems to self-identify, although this isn't entirely certain, as a Pharisee. At the very least, he's very sympathetic towards them. But, on the other hand...
More surprising that they left out Kohanim in the chain.
Right. So that might be part of the reason why. Chazal are very well aware that there are problems with the Kohen. In fact, that's why, this is an important point, that's why when the Mishnah discusses what happens on Erev Yom Kippur, and it talks about preparing the Kohen Gadol for her service, the assumption that the Mishnah makes is that the Kohen Gadol is an Amaretz. He doesn't know what he's talking about. That seems to me to be quite a big difference between what's presented in Chazal and what's presented in the Chumash. The Chumash, the assumption is that the Kohen Gadol is going to be in charge of everything. Whereas by the time you get to Chazal, there is, I think you're correct, a realization that we need to look elsewhere for sources of authority and for sources of continuity in Jewish tradition. It's an important point. Now, the second...
That doesn't mean necessarily that the most qualified person was in charge.
True.
But in the rabbinic tradition, it was always the person who was the most intellectually advanced, so therefore he had a different qualitative character to the different lines.
Absolutely, and that is one thing that distinguishes, I think, being a Rav from being a Kohen. You know, Halacha is, if you have a choice between giving an aliyah to a Kohen Gadol Amaretz and a Mamzer Talmid Chacham, so every rabbi is quick to point out that they're Mamzerim Talmid Chacham. So that we are all, that at the very least, there is, in other words, there is this tension between your hereditary prowess as a priest and your intellectual prowess as being a sage. That is absolutely true. Now, the second source, to me, when I first encountered it years ago, was absolutely stunning because it shattered all of my preconceptions, and this was what sort of led me on the path of preparing this course. It's an absolutely stunning set of sources, and I hope you'll be as excited as I am to read what there is inside. The next set of sources is from a genre of Christian literature called the Pseudo-Clementines. It's not a... what they are not is another form of delicious orange, as much as I wish that was true. The Pseudo-Clementines refer to two... broadly speaking, texts that are basically the oldest form of Christian novel that we have. They're basically novels, and in a 4th century context, which is when they were put together, finally edited, they would have been perceived as extremely exciting and gripping. Now, not so much, but such was the nature of audiences, popular audiences back then. They're two novels, and what they talk about is the life, they document the life of Clement of Rome, one of the early bishops of Christianity, and in particular, they purport to document his travels with the Apostle Peter around the world of Christendom. The texts that we're now, these texts are based upon an earlier source. They both share in common, and these two texts, the earlier one called the Homilies, and the later one called the Recognitions. These two texts make up the Pseudo-Clementine novels. These two texts are different, but they clearly are based on a common source that is probably to be dated sometime within the first 3 centuries of the Common Era, probably the 3rd century, maybe a little bit earlier. But in any event, they preserve traditions and betray perspectives on Christian history that not only differ from the Pauline perspective that we're used to from reading A, the Gospels, and B, the Church Fathers, but in fact betray a perspective on Pauline Christianity that is hostile in an unmitigated fashion. These sources are violently opposed to Paul and Pauline Christianity. Now take a look at what I take a look at one example that I've given you. This is, I don't have my source number, anti-Pauline Christianity. I've given you two sources side by side, one from the homilies and one from Acts, which we've actually seen. The one on the left, is, which I've titled the Epistle of Peter to James, is a letter that's tacked on to the beginning of the work, the pseudo-Clementine novel called the Homilies, and it purports to be a letter that the Apostle Peter wrote to James. Now, who is James? Does anyone recall?
Brother.
Yaakov Achieshu, right? James is the brother of Osa Ha'ish, according to several sources, the Gospels, first of all, Josephus, second of all, and according to, now, whereas we saw in previous classes, and just no prior background than this is required, but just to briefly recap, we saw in a previous class that the Gospels, in particular Luke and Acts and those and works like that, portray the history of Christianity after Jesus as sort of a compromise that's worked out between Paul and James and Peter, and they all represent different views on what, on how much of the halacha we have to keep, and eventually they come to an agreement. James will keep the halacha, and Peter will sort of be somewhere in the middle, and Paul will abandon the halacha and preach to the Gentiles. And eventually, we're used to thinking, the Pauline paradigm becomes dominant, wherein the law is completely abandoned, and there's no notion, in fact, that Jews and Christians are the same at all. For the pseudo-Clementines, the only source of legitimate authority in the church is James. Is James, who insists that you must keep the halacha, that you must keep Torah's Moshe. And Peter, in fact, is recorded as saying the following in the homilies. Take a look at that source. Some from among the Gentiles have rejected my legal preaching, attaching themselves to certain lawless and trifling preaching of the man, and this is Paul, who is my enemy. Some have attempted these things while I'm still alive to transform my words, and here he's referring to whoever compiled Luke in the book of Acts, by certain intricate interpretations toward the dissolution of the law, as though I myself were also of such a mind, but did not freely proclaim it. God forbid. Says the homilies, there are some people who say that I, Peter, abandoned halacha, or told people they didn't have to keep halacha. Chas v'shalom! This is a gloss, and we don't have time to read it, I don't think. This is in fact disputing the homilies in its earliest form clearly had Acts in front of it, and it was disputing the traditions in Acts. We're going to see another source, which I think is even more important later on, about how the words of Jesus are interpreted completely differently. The same words in Acts on the one hand, or rather in Matthew on one hand, and in the pseudo-Clementine homilies on the other hand. So we'll take a look in just a second.
How did such a thing survive over the centuries if it was so
right, so this is an excellent question. The answer is, we actually have to try and figure out at what point would Christians worldwide have taken it as a given that this was wrong? Answer number one is that it survives in places, whether in Greek or in Syriac translation, sometimes in Slavonic translation. It survives in places where the Catholic Church couldn't have reached it, and even the sort of Eastern Orthodox Church, the Byzantine Orthodox Church, either wouldn't have been aware of it or also couldn't have reached it. So it survives in places where it was beyond the clutches of those who would have censored it. But that's an excellent question. It's one that needs to be grappled with. Now, so clearly the homilies are portraying a different perspective on the history of Christianity and are not going to take the Pauline line. They're not going to say, well, you have Judaism on the one hand, and Jews will insist on keeping the law. That's ridiculous, so we're going to tell Gentiles not to keep the law. And eventually, the two are going to be inexorably disentangled. That position is mocked and is derided by the homilies. And instead, they're going to adopt a different position. Now, what I'd like to do is quickly read to you the core of how the homilies envisions the role of Jesus. In other words, if we have to all keep halacha, then what is Jesus' role? So I'm going to read you this in this next portion, how the core reality of how the homilies envisions this, and then we're going to have to ask a crucial question. So now pay attention closely to what the homilies says. Homilies reports, Jesus is concealed from the Hebrews who have taken Moses as their teacher, just as Moses is hidden from those who have believed Jesus. Since there is a single teaching by both, God accepts one who has believed either of these. To believe a teacher is for the sake of doing the things spoken by God. And our Lord himself says that this is so. And he goes on to quote different verses. Thus, God himself has concealed the teacher from some who foreknew, i.e. the Jews, who foreknew that they should do whatever they were supposed to do. In other words, to keep the Torah. And he has revealed Jesus to others, i.e. Gentiles, who are ignorant about what they should do. So what is he saying is the role of Jesus? Is he saying to supplant Moshe? In other words, what he says here is God accepts one who has believed either of these. Right, exactly. Dr. Schwarzman is right. Jesus' role is not to preach to Jews at all. His role is to leave Judaism be and take the message of Judaism, which is identical, he says, to the message of Moses, and bring it to the Gentiles. In other words, he's just supposed to do what James is saying to do, as we interpret it. In other words, he's trying to take Jewish teachings, the teachings of monotheism, perhaps, as we'll see in a moment, or maybe even in the next class, halachic teachings, and give them to Gentiles. Now, why do things shake out this way? We're going to have to see in a moment. But the question that must be asked now is this. And the view of the homilies on sort of the value of Jewish tradition is a complicated one. I don't mean to sort of just say they wanted Gentiles to observe the Mishnah. That's not what they were going for. In other words, they have a complex view, and in many cases, from our perspective, and I think from any perspective, just completely inadmissible view of what Judaism means. But that said, they do want people to keep the basic laws of Moses. Now, if that's the case, what would you imagine the reaction would be, or the perspective would be, of the author or authors of the Pseudo-Clementine homilies on Jewish claims to a Masorah? It's a difficult question. How would a person who thinks this react to Jewish claims of Masorah?
New version that they'll understand.
Right. So in other words, what they might say is Jewish Masorah is what it is, and perhaps it might be right. And in fact, it almost must be right.
Their Masorah is our Masorah.
Their Masorah is our Masorah.
Right, but they aren't getting the message across.
So take a look at the next source, the homilies on the Pharisees. There is a source, and we have read this source, actually, in previous classes. Well, and so I hope this will be sort of a fresh... For those who were there, this will be a fresh new spin on it. And for those who weren't, you have a chance to look at it for the... One of my teachers once told me, Dr. Moshe Bernstein, he said, you can only read a text for the first time once. I think it's an important insight into how we read literature. But this is one of those examples. Matthew 23. Matthew 23, last time we saw it, is all about traditions about Jesus attacking the Pharisees. The gospel traditions wherein the Pharisees and all that they stand for are hammered and hammered and hammered. One of the earliest sayings that are attributed to Jesus in this passage is the following. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, so do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do, for they preach but do not practice." This is a famous crux in Matthew, because Jesus seems, in the beginning of the sentence, to be saying one thing, and at the end of it, to be saying another. And the Gospels, as we noted last time that we saw this, seem to be engaging in some sort of acrobatic trick to try and harmonize the nice things that Jesus says about the law and the Pharisees and so on with the bad things that either they have as a tradition from Jesus or that they themselves believe about the Pharisees. The important thing is as follows. Jesus makes a claim about the Pharisees here. And what is that? And is it positive? What claim does Jesus make here about the Pharisees? He says they sit on the seat of Moses.
Their lineage is valid.
Their lineage is valid. Or at the very least, their pronouncements, their legal pronouncements, or their theological pronouncements, are authoritative. They have authority. But, so now what does Matthew do with this? They're hypocrites, right? They don't practice, as Dr. Schwarzman says, what they preach. As Ms. Federer says, they are hypocrites. So that's what Matthew does with this. And you might assume, if you only read the Gospels, that that's exactly what Jesus meant. There is another interpretation. Whether this is the correct one is immaterial. What it does, why it is important is because it tells us what followers of Jesus, believers in Jesus, were thinking in 4th century Syria. Ask your father and he will tell you, your elders and they will declare to you in the next source. It's necessary to seek this father. In other words, they had just been talking about how there is this figure called a true prophet. In other words, this one prophet that appears again and again throughout history, Adam, Moses, Elijah, and then eventually, according to the homily of Jesus, and you have to believe him. And to make further, so in other words, you have to listen to the prophets, and you have to make further search for these elders, the Jews. But you have not sought out concerning the one to whose time belongs the kingdom and to whom belongs the seat of prophecy, even though he himself, Jesus namely, points this out himself, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in the seat of Moses. All things that they say to you, hear them. Hear them, he said, as entrusted with the key of the kingdom, which is knowledge, which alone can open the gate of life, through which alone is the entrance to eternal life. Truly, he says, Jesus says, the Pharisees possess the key, but those wishing to enter, they do not suffer to do so. On this account, I say, he himself rising from his seat, namely Jesus, also Aish, like a father for his children, proclaiming the things which from the beginning were transmitted in secret to the worthy, extending mercy even to the Gentiles, and having compassion for the souls of all, neglected his own blood. So what claim is he making here? How is he interpreting the words of Jesus? He's interpreting them differently from Matthew. Matthew said, the Pharisees may be right technically, but they're hypocrites, so you shouldn't listen to them. The homilies are saying, no, you have to listen to the Pharisees. And he doesn't have that bit about how they don't practice what they preach. In fact, elsewhere in the Pseudo-Clementine literature, it makes reference to the view of some of the gospel, the Pauline, the gospel writers who end up following what we would call Pauline Christianity. And he makes reference to them and says, the Pharisees that Jesus criticized were exceptions. Really, he respected the Pharisees and liked the Pharisees. There were certain Pharisees, just like there are certain members of any group, who were hypocritical. He was criticizing them, not because they were Pharisees, but because they were just personally bad people. The claim that he's making here is that, A, the Pharisees are respected by Jesus, B, the Pharisees have traditions that are important and that are keys for salvation or whatever, and C, you should seek them out, because they can tell you things that will help you. Fourth century Syria. Christians in fourth century Syria are writing this. And moreover, what claim do they make, in particular, about the Masorah of the Pharisees? Take a look at that next source. This one is Lulim. In other words, if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't have believed it. The law of God, says the homilies, was given through Moses without writing to 70 wise men to be handed down, to be conveyed, so that the government might be carried on by succession. This is how he describes Masorah. He says, there is a written Torah, and there is a Torah that is not written. The not written Torah was given over to the elders, and the elders pass it down one to another until it gets to, as he eventually concludes, the Pharisees of today. He's describing Torah Shebaal Peh. He's describing Torah Shebaal Peh as would have been, in other words, claims of this sort would have been made by contemporaries of this author in 4th century Eretz Yisrael. So the claim that he's making here is that exactly. In other words, they're legitimizing themselves not on what we would call supersessionist grounds. Eusebius is making the claim that Christianity has superseded Judaism. Judaism is completely irrelevant now, and therefore he needs to destroy Jewish claims to Masorah. The Pseudo-Clementine homilies are not making that claim. They're claiming exactly that Christianity has supplemented Judaism. And in other words, they make all sorts of other outlandish claims that we couldn't accept. But their basic framework is, because our legitimacy derives ultimately from Judaism, it is in our best interests to shore up Jewish claims for Masorah. And therefore, they make essentially, not entirely, but very similar claims to the ones that we found in Avos. And they even go beyond it.
Where is the quote in the actual Gospels where he says, I have not come to change a jot or tittle of the Torah?
Right, so that was one of the sources in previous classes that we examined when we attempted to prove, and I think overwhelmingly, I hope we succeeded, that Jesus himself would never have had a havamina, to deviate from Torah law. The Gospels actually have a very difficult time interpreting that passage. And just like they do with this passage in Matthew, they go out of their way to try and figure out that it must mean something else. Yes? Oh, no, sure, okay. So just, in other words, to bring this all to a close, what we're seeing here is, first of all, of historical interest. Number one, even at this late date, the 4th century, around the Council of Nicaea, a little bit before, perhaps a little bit after, probably a little bit after, there are still debates raging amongst Christians, some in Eretz Yisrael, some in Asia Minor, and in this case, some in Syria, where it's clear that the issue of how to view the role of Jesus and the status of Toras Moshe is up for grabs. And so, first, as an historical perspective, it's worth noting that as much as we identified in our last class a definite point at which there were certain prominent Christians who clearly no longer self-identified as Jews and defined Christianity over against Judaism, there are still Christians who do not so self-identify, and in fact are asserting the continued vitality of Jewish tradition. And I should note, this source in the homilies goes even further than Avos. Avos doesn't mention a Torah Sheba'al Peh. And in fact, the phrase Torah Sheba'al Peh appears nowhere, anywhere in the Mishnah. This source is claiming that there is a Torah Sheba'al Peh. And in fact, the idea that unwritten traditions are passed down faithfully from Chacham to Chacham, from Prushi to Prushi, from Pharisee to Pharisee, is part of what it sees as giving its own tradition, the author sees giving its own tradition vitality. Now, why is this important to us? In recent months, and I don't want to get into the particulars of who is right and who is wrong, in recent months, you might say years, the question of who possesses Masorah, who possesses tradition, who should rightly be seen as the arbiters of Jewish practice, and so on and so forth, has either become a hot-button issue, a topic of very sensitive discussion, or it's been dismissed. Everybody should decide for themselves, and the idea of tradition, consulting with elders, is seen as something that is a relic of an older age. Now, I don't mean to get into the nitty-gritty of the particular issues at bar. I will say, however, that it seems to me that from multiple perspectives, part and parcel of what defines us as a community, as we've seen here, not just in our own eyes, in the Mishnah, but in the eyes of those who either hated us or needed us, were Jewish claims to Masorah, were Jewish claims to traditions being passed down from one person to another. Now, nowadays we don't have what we would define, strictly speaking, as smicha. In other words, the idea of one person who had smicha going all the way back, as tradition has it, to the earliest sages of the Chumash, cannot pass down their traditions to somebody else because that chain has been somehow broken. But the idea of learning from a teacher and having that teacher convey things to you that he learned from his teacher or she learned from her teacher and so on and so forth, I think is what makes our tradition vital. And that, parenthetically, is why we celebrated last week, although I was not technically part of it, Echag HaSmicha, a celebration of this very idea of Masorah. Because for us, as a community, this is what distinguishes us. To an extent, it's important that we all be, as Rabbi Soloveitchik taught us and his disciples taught us, it is important to be a free thinker, to be independent-minded, and to be sensitive to the vicissitudes of modern life and contemporaneous developments, whether it be in issues of sociology or otherwise, but at the same time, focus should not be shifted away from the importance of Masorah. And to the extent that we can, wherever we fall on these contentious issues, whether it be women's issues or something else, however we frame our positions and whatever conclusions we come to, we should try to frame our arguments in some way so that they respect the crucial part that Masorah has played in our history. Yes. Yes.
If that is the case, and that's the belief, why do you have so many Gedolim who refuse to be Poseidon?
Ah, right. So, An interesting thing to note is that the way that the Mishnah in Avos is structured is as follows. There are people who have done Pirkei Avos between Pesach, and this is also in Yom Hadin, between Pesach and Shavuos will know how many Prakim of Pirkei Avos are there?
Six.
The sixth one is a late addition. The original Maseches Avos has five Prakim. The last parak is somewhat of an anomaly, but the first four prakim are structured as follows. The first two are structured around the genealogy that we saw, in other words, the scholarly genealogy that we saw. In other words, it's Moshe gave it to one person, that single person gave it to another single person, and eventually it branches out to two people, right? Antigone Shisoho gives it to Yosef ben Yoezer, and so on, and Yosef ben Yochanan, and they pass it down to another two people, and the first two chapters are all about the tradition being passed down generation to generation, each generation represented by no more than two people. In the third and fourth chapters, that's when the whole thing breaks down. The last person to be mentioned on the list of singular individuals is, does anyone remember? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, one of the late sages of the Second Temple period. After him,
and he only has nine Tekanos, five to nine.
Yes, and he has how many Talmidim? Five Talmidim, if I recall. And then after that, in the third and fourth chapters, Avos is now structured not as one person passing down to another person or two passing down to two. It's structured by generation. In other words, these are all the sages of the first generation. These are all the sages of the third generation. These are all the sages of the fourth generation. These are all the sages of the fifth generation until we get to the end. So at a certain point, in other words, we have both models in Judaism. We have the model of many, in other words, the model of the third and fourth prakim of Pirkei Avos, wherein sages proliferate, and as many people as are able, paskan halacha, as it were. And if you feel that you're qualified, then you do. But we also have the model in the first two prakim of Pirkei Avos, whereby psak, or the ability to receive and transmit the tradition, is circumscribed in a sense, and it's given only to the greatest sage of that generation, or perhaps the greatest. Or perhaps somebody who was related to the greatest sage of the previous generation. So, which model should be observed today, has been observed in previous generations? That's an open question. But it's worth pointing out that both models actually do exist in Maseches Avos. Right. Yes.
I was going to say, it's sad, because you see right at the breaking point when Christianity broke off from Judaism, they have a very valid and controversial, very sadly, a lot of communities where they were very strict in terms of teaching, but they were intolerant
right.
of people. And so that's really their criticism, is that they didn't accept people. There was no, so they're teaching chesed, but they're not practicing it. And this is what, and probably they're correct
and that's
what they're saying.
And that's the big problem, and I think what distinguishes Jewish sources from Christian sources in, let's say, the 3rd, 4th century, that Christians develop a genre of what's called heresiology. Develop this heresiology, which is basically the science, if you were, of identifying heretics and excising them from the community. So they have this very sophisticated, Epiphanius is a famous one that we'll hopefully look at in three classes, Epiphanius catalogs like 100 different or 150 different heresies, describes each one specifically, makes fun of all of them in order to be yotze, making fun of heretics, and then he tries to bring proofs again. Yeah, and he tells you how to find them, exactly. Jews don't have this. In other words, the Jews focus basically on themselves, even to the extent that there is a category called a min, which we would basically translate as heretic, as we'll see in a couple of classes. It could refer to wildly disparate groups. It could refer to Christians. It could also refer to what we might call generally, perhaps inaccurately, as Gnostics. It could refer to basic pagans. It could refer to all sorts of peoples, because the rabbis weren't as concerned to define and catalog heretics and make sure that they were pushed out of the community. They were much more interested in focusing on ourselves, how to improve our own community and how to develop our own community, which I think is an important Musar Haskel. We're going to examine that in 3 weeks' time. Yes, let me just quickly stop the recording here.